From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan restaurants and diners face the reopening of indoor service.
I talked to one restaurant owner who said, there's your group that'll be here as soon as they can. There's another group that's only going to eat outside no matter what, even now in the winter. And there's that third group that, for now, they'll get carry out, but we're not going to see them until we're truly in a post-pandemic situation.
Also, tales from Prohibition in the Toledo-Detroit-Windsor corridor.
Toledo-Detroit area was the mecca of organized crime because of the odd mobility of the region. Cars were essential tools for these criminals.
And order up wings for one, please. Some culinary tips for your pandemic Super Bowl weekend.
I will be watching the game, and by watching, I will be scrolling Facebook Marketplace on the couch while eating approximately 50 wings.
Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we jump into the Wayback Machine to revisit the time when Michiganders were clamoring for alcohol and rum runners were going to extremes to sell it to them.
In Michigan, Prohibition starts in 1918, but Ohio doesn't adopt it. So therefore, you could go down to Toledo, Ohio as a Michigan resident, purchase booze, and then try to smuggle it back.
That's in the second half of the hour. But first, restaurants are back open in Michigan. For the first time since mid-November, you can make reservations and grab a meal or drinks indoors. Today, we learned that Detroit's Mayor Mike Duggan has just expanded vaccine eligibility to people working in the city's restaurants and grocery stores. Some restaurant owners and staff have a cautious optimism for a slow return to normalcy, but that normal is still far from certain. Michigan Radio's Tyler Scott has been out talking to folks in restaurants. Some are frustrated by the new COVID restrictions, and others are waiting to see if indoor dining is going to last before they bring back their staff. Hey, Tyler.
Hey, April. Good to talk to you again.
So what kind of demand are restaurants seeing right now? We're 2 days into the period in which Governor Whitmer said they could be open again.
Yeah, well, it seems there's always that slice of people who are wanting to and willing to go out and eat at a restaurant as soon as they're allowed to. I talked to more than a dozen restaurants in the past week about folks getting ready for this relaunch of indoor dining. And Monday, one of them at Singerman's Roadhouse in Ann Arbor, they had somebody standing outside the door at 8 o'clock in the morning waiting for them to open up for breakfast. From what I saw yesterday driving around Southeast Michigan, lunch was a little slow, but a lot of places were saying they were getting reservations, not just yesterday, but in the past few days and weeks, people looking to, go out to eat again and make Valentine's Day reservations right around the corner. So it seems that people are trying to get out there, even as other slices of the population. I talked to one restaurant owner who said, there's your group that'll be here as soon as they can. There's another group that's only going to eat outside no matter what, even now in the winter. And there's that third group that, for now, they'll get carry out, but we're not going to see them until we're truly in a post-pandemic situation.
Huh. Tyler, did you get a sense that most places are opening up for indoor dining if they have a chance to?
Yeah, it's kind of self-selecting a little bit because it's hard to talk to the restaurants who are closed down right now.
Right.
But the Michigan Restaurant and Lodging Association says, according to members that it surveyed, WXYZ-TV reported 60% said they were going to open up for indoor dining. And there's a lot of factors that go into it. I didn't talk to any restaurant manager or owner that expects to profit off 25% capacity, whether they're opening or not. But on the other hand, some people are opening up because they're a restaurant. That's what they're here to do.
How did you see owners of restaurants and operators reacting to the restrictions that are placed on indoor dining? I mean, everybody still has to stay pretty spaced out, right?
Yeah, and for the most part, there was a lot of frustration with the 25% number. It's a lot of a mixed bag because people are happy to have a chance, like you said at the beginning, to serve people indoors again, but they wish they could be open at 50% like they were back in the summer and fall before they had to totally shut down indoor dining. Like I said, none of them expect to make money maxing their capacity out at 25% of what they could usually do. But there are a few that between the new COVID variant that's in Southeast Michigan, and the uncertainty right now of not exactly knowing what to expect between carryout and dine-in, what demand is going to look like. Like Amy Koopman, she's the general manager at Zaruna Mediterranean Grill in Kalamazoo, and she said she's actually pretty happy, and we have some tape, about that 25% restriction makes it kind of easier to ease back into things.
Actually, we're pretty relieved, honestly, about the 25% rule, just to kind of get the staff back into trying to handle indoor and out, or takeout and dining at the same time. So just kind of taking it easy at first.
She was concerned about a situation where, you know, the dining room could be full at 25%, and maybe the phone's also ringing off the hook for carryout. So still in this first week back, kind of feeling things out, not just in an operations way in terms of knowing what to expect for customers, but some places I've talked to also waiting to bring back some staff until they see, you know, is this phase of indoor dining going to stick? Are we going to be able to go up in capacity soon? What exactly is going to happen? They're waiting to see.
Did anybody talk to you about the way that they're making these decisions about whether or not to stay open, or, you know, how many tables they're going to put outside or things like that?
Yeah, you know, mostly for, like I said, other than Amy, a lot of restaurant owners that I talk to are feeling kind of hemmed in by the current restrictions. And like, as I've said several times, operating at 25% capacity, they're not going to make any profit. Several people said the same phrase to me, which was opening right now is only going to allow them to lose less money. But if they can bring people in the door, that's what they're going to do. Nobody put it to me better than Chris Szabo, who's the co-owner of the Antlers restaurant in Sault Ste. Marie up in the UP.
I mean, there's a break-even point for every business. And 25% of what we were normally doing, sure ain't it. You know, a lot of people say, oh, it's better than nothing. No, it's not necessarily. You know, we're going to open because, you know, we want to see some faces. We want to get going. But it ain't going to make us any money.
And Chris told me that they scaled back their staff when they had to shut down indoor dining. They're down to a real skeleton crew at this point, and they're not bringing anybody back yet. They're going to see kind of how it goes at first.
It definitely sounds like survival mode. What does this mean for the restaurant industry workforce as far as jobs? I'm sure we're nowhere close to where we were in terms of employment levels.
Yeah, I haven't seen the numbers yet exactly, but I've just talked to so many restaurants in the past week that say, just like Szabo up there at the Antlers, we're not going to go hire everybody back immediately like we're prepared to go into a rush of indoor dining. Let's wait this out and take this slow. And, you know, it depends so much on restaurant by restaurant, business by business. If you've been able to get by okay with carryout, and delivery and that sort of thing, and you've got your staff that's been working at reduced hours, and then there are places that have had to lay everybody off because they've been totally shut down, and they don't want to bring people back now only to have to lay them off again if there's bad news down the road and indoor dining reverses course and gets shut down. Andy French owns Aubrey's Pizzeria in Ypsilanti, and he was telling me about exactly this.
25% is better than shut down, but it is still a difficult place for us to be. And that's one of the reasons why we haven't called anyone back. We really want to see kind of what this looks like.
French told me that when they opened for lunch, they were pleasantly surprised by what they saw as far as foot traffic. And they did have a couple reservations. But for now, you know, take it slow and easy.
Tyler, we are so far from having folks who were in service industry be part of a priority group in terms of vaccinations. Did you talk to any workers about how safe they feel about all this?
For the most part, there was a lot of eagerness to get back to work for people that I've seen just anecdotally on social media, in addition to who I've talked to. And the idea of workplace safety did come up as a concern, though, even with these restrictions in place. You know, your servers and your bartenders and the like are the people who are interfacing with customers, who have to trust and depend on folks acting how they're supposed to act in this COVID area and stay safe. As far as vaccinations, one server I talked to, Brianna Duncan, she was telling me she can't wait to get vaccinated. She's been told that her job will help her get vaccinated through the local health department as soon as that supply is there on a local level. In the meantime, she just hopes that Brianna hopes that people will be, you know, courteous when they do go out.
I think it's really hit or miss. People either really care and they're really careful, or they don't at all, and you have to constantly remind them to put their mask back on. And you have to deal with like people being upset at you for doing your job. But like, there's people like me, like I have a genetic blood disease. I will die if I get COVID, but this is what I do. So like, I'm not gonna take myself out of what I do for a living, but I expect people to be respectful enough that I wanna like live long enough to make it through COVID. And that's the biggest issue I think is gonna be a problem with having everything open again.
So she's right at that crossroads of trying to balance safety with, you know, she's got to make a living.
Yeah. Driving around, there are a couple of places that have chosen to try the outdoor dining option, either in terms of having some heaters, you know, stand-up heaters or propane heaters that they put next to the tables, or I've even seen a few plastic igloos, these domes that get put over a small table. Did you get a chance to talk to anyone, either who was a server or a restaurant owner, about whether people are taking advantage of that or how it's working out?
Yeah, I actually stopped by Black Diesel Coffee on the south side of Ann Arbor, and they've got some, they've had for a while now, those dome igloos, like you mentioned. And there was a couple groups in there sharing some igloos and sharing a coffee when I stopped by. Didn't poke my head in there because I didn't want to, you know, intrude on their, you know, air circulation they had going on. But I talked to the general manager inside, and he said, yeah, that's something we have going. Now we can have a few people in here too. That's great. We're going to keep them up and see how it goes. Give people that option. Nobody wants to be operating at 25% of capacity, right? Regardless of safety, you want to be able to do 100% of what you can do. So businesses that are trying these outdoor seating arrangements, even here in a Michigan winter, are unlikely, I think, to give that up now. They're just looking to serve whoever they can, however they can.
Michigan Radio's Tyler Scott. Tyler, thank you so much for the update.
No problem.
Next up, we're going to check in with a restaurateur in Traverse City who we spoke with last May about how her experience of reopening is going.
We'll survive for sure on the strength of the people that work there and the community, but It was a very, very challenging winter, and we just tried to make the most of it and stay as positive as we could as well.
That's coming up in just a minute. You're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've been talking about the reopening of Michigan's restaurants for in-person dining. It has been a dark, bleak winter for everyone in the service industry. We thought it'd be a good time to go back and speak with someone we first met last spring. Amanda Danielson is the co-owner of Trattoria Stella in Traverse City. Her place serves fine Italian cuisine and fine wines. Amanda, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Do you have any bookings yet?
We do. The phone started ringing. We actually are opening officially tomorrow, even though we could have on Monday. But the phone started ringing as soon as the governor announced February 1st.
This is just like what happened to you in the summer. I remember the last time we talked, you were absolutely swamped with reservations as soon as it became obvious that restaurants were going to be allowed to open doors.
I think the biggest difference is, if you remember when we opened in May, it was just our zone that was reopening. And it was also right before a holiday weekend. So we were inundated with calls from all over the state and country of people that were actually traveling to those few areas that were open for regular business. This time, the whole state is being treated as one unit. And so I think there's, and it's, you know, it's winter time here, even though it's a mild winter. And I think people are not as, they don't feel as forced. Like if they want to go out, they have to go up north. They can go out in their own restaurants in their own neighborhoods and their own towns and cities.
Sure. What were things like for you in November and December this year?
Miserable. I mean, we did the best that we could for sure, trying to get creative and also trying to serve our community with lower price because everybody's struggling a little bit. And so we had lower price family meals that were going to continue that people could pre-order ahead of time. We created an online wine store. We started a wine club. We expanded our carryout options. We just really tried to get as creative as we could, especially given that we're in a historic building and had no opportunity for outdoor seating. So we really couldn't do any kind of actual table service. We had to rely exclusively on carryout sales, period.
And I know that you really did put some thought into this. There's a whole list of family meal menu options on the website that people have been able to choose from. How did that work out?
It worked out really well. You know, I think, like you said, without any dining capacity, you can't even talk about sales. They're minuscule compared to what we're accustomed to. And we really wanted to keep our management staff employed as well, because the unemployment benefits aren't nearly as close to their actual salaries as they previously were. So we made the business decision to try to just be that good member of the community that we've been, you know, for almost 17 years now, and try to create those opportunities where we can participate in the community, still serve the community, still maintain the high level of quality that we always have. And I think that the community, many of our regular guests turned out in response to that and in support of us, which was great. Unfortunately, without those in-house dining sales, you know, I mean, it was still, I mean, we lost more in November and December and up until, I mean, in all winter. It's just, it was devastating for our business. You know, we had to close the Franklin, and Stella will survive for sure on the strength of the people that work there. And the community, but it was a very, very challenging winter, and we just tried to make the most of it and stay as positive as we could as well.
Sure. How's your staff doing?
Great. You know, we kept our management staff, the whole team of managers employed, which was wonderful. And actually, it's been fun to watch because, you know, with so much less to do, We've got these very highly skilled people basically running the show, and they've been extraordinary, like truly extraordinary watching them do that. And we brought our servers back, our top tier of servers back starting yesterday, just to get the dining room refreshed and ready to receive guests starting tomorrow. And everyone was just really chomping at the bit to get back to work, cleaning, just setting up the dining room. People are just excited. You know, honestly, I would say our staff is also on the mature side of things. It's not a young transient staff as some sectors of our industry tends to have. We have a very long, I think everybody there has been with us for over 10 years at least. So we have that level of commitment on the part of our staff, and it was great to see everybody's faces yesterday for sure.
Did everyone who you called choose to come back?
Yes, we haven't called back everybody yet, but everyone that we did call back of the house and front of the house has committed to coming back. And again, we saw all those faces of our front of the house, our service staff back yesterday.
How did it feel to be able to make those calls?
It was spectacular. Remember last time the unemployment benefits were significant, and for some people, depending on their position, they actually made more to stay at home. And just to receive the benefits plus the extra federal benefits. This time, that's not really the case. And so I think even though the people that we called would have come back no matter what, there will be, I think, with that next tier of people, less fallout than the last time, because there aren't that financial reward for staying home.
Right. You know, I saw a photo on Instagram the other day that was taken in Los Angeles, and it showed restaurants, in a thriving business district, and the restaurant tables outdoors, of course, were absolutely packed. The person who posted it had a pretty harsh take on what he was seeing. His concern was that the working class in LA are paying the price because people with health insurance, people of means, want to dine out. There's no doubt in my mind that some people who are servers or who work in the kitchen are feeling enormous relief at having the opportunity to get back to work. But I'm sure that some of them are also very frightened about COVID and not sure when they're going to be able to get a vaccine. You know, I'm not trying to put all this on the back of restaurant owners, but are your feelings at all mixed about being able to reopen this week?
I'm more concerned about just how utterly unbalanced the response to this has been toward the restaurant industry. I'll give you an example. I can think of five people who have been able, through whatever means, to get vaccines who are really in their professions, not remotely at risk. And one of the factors that the CDC put out was to be able to get back to some level of social normalcy, which is how they determined the tiers, right, and the groups of people, a combination of public health and a combination of being able to return to some level of commerce. We should be on the front. I mean, if I'm not worried about us reopening because we did it safely before, and we'll do it safely again. We've always prioritized the safety of our staff and the safety of our guests. I know that we can do that safely. I have no problem enforcing the protocols from MDHHS. But my issue is more is that I don't think that people are doing enough, that the government is doing enough to support and protect those restaurant workers. They've already disproportionately affected our incomes, both from ownership all the way down to the front lines, to the bussers and the cooks and the dishwashers and the servers and the bartenders, et cetera. We should have greater priority in order to be able to take advantage of additional safety protocols. And I really believe that vaccines are one of those things. Now, that said, there are a lot of people that are high-risk people that also aren't being able to get it. And I'm not saying we should supersede that group, but there are plenty of people that are receiving the vaccine that, you know, work alone in an office or a lab, but somehow by some grace, they fall under a category and they really aren't nearly at risk, where we're dealing with the public every single day. It is our responsibility to keep ourselves safe. I flew recently and I wore my KN95 mask and a surgical mask over it just because I know it's my responsibility to keep myself safe. And my staff will certainly do that too. We actually provide them with masks that are safe and CDC compliant. But I think that extra layer of safety and comfort would be a wonderful thing to offer to an industry that's been disproportionately affected in a negative way by all the policies since the beginning, and certainly since November.
Amanda Danielson is the co-owner of Trattoria Stella in Traverse City. Amanda, thank you so much for talking to us, and we wish you all the luck for the rest of the winter.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
If it seems like the only place you feel truly safe digging in is at home these days, you do have the opportunity to set the table for the upcoming Super Bowl feast, arguably the second biggest culinary event of the year after Thanksgiving, especially here in the Midwest. Bon Appetit's senior staff writer Alex Beggs has a monthly questionable etiquette column called Is It Ever Okay?, where she answers readers' burning questions about bad manners and more. It is one of the reads that's been getting us through this season. Alex Beggs, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, April.
So what are your Super Bowl plans this year?
I will be watching the game, and by watching, I will be scrolling Facebook Marketplace on the couch while eating approximately 50 wings.
We have the second screen in the plate. I think that's the proper setting, the proper table setting for such a situation.
Coffee table setting, yeah.
Right. Was the Super Bowl a thing when you were growing up? I mean, did you have sort of a food that like your family absolutely had on the table when the sport ball was on?
We gathered for any food opportunity, and the only thing that is most memorable to me is my Aunt Yolanda's 7-layer dip, which came up a lot in the questions for Super Bowl etiquette. People either love it or they hate it. 7-layer dip has beautiful parts to it, guacamole, refried beans, and then it will just kind of have wet, cold things like pico de gallo or iceberg lettuce. So you either love it or hate it, but I love my Aunt Yolanda's, so that's a fond memory. Thanks for asking.
Alex, who hates 7-layer dips? Seriously. I mean, are these...
Well, someone asked, could they eat just the guacamole layer? Which, valid question, but I think maybe rude in a social setting when someone's gone to the trouble of layering 7 whole layers.
That sounds like something my 10-year-old would do. No. Well, in your Super Bowl edition of Is It Ever Okay, people had lots of questions really about form too. I mean, what does the Super Bowl party look like this year? How do you envision a socially distant Super Bowl party?
Well, I wrote this months ago before the extra contagious variant of COVID was going around. So now I regret even suggesting a socially distant outdoor party, which doesn't sound very fun to me because it's so cold outside, but I'm not especially hardy in the cold Michigan weather. I do think I wouldn't even bother with making individual servings for everyone. Just have them bring their own food. Then you can bring whatever snack you want to eat, and you don't have to worry about creating these perfectly sanitary conditions in your kitchen before you serve people possibly pandemic nachos.
I know that in some parts of the country there are different specialties. You've got your meatball on a popsicle stick. You've got your stroganoff over baked potato. But for me, it's really about the wings. I remember that last year you wrote an article for Basically, which is a blog that Bon Appetit runs for online recipes about all the ways to make chicken wings at home. What are some of your favorites?
I love wings. I really miss eating them at a bar, so it's hard to recreate that at home. But I love the Basically recipe for buffalo wings. It's kind of like your classic Frank's Red Hot and butter sauce. I skip the sugar. I think you can kind of go either way depending on what you like there. But in the oven, they get nice and crispy, and then you douse them in sauce. It's less of a mess than frying them. And that's my personal favorite of our recipes, but we have other great ones too that have like maybe more of a honey and soy sauce ginger flavor or spice rubs. So you can kind of follow your heart.
Do you think there's a special trick to getting them really crispy?
Couple techniques, and I also wrote an entire story last year about why we love crispy so much, so I do feel like an expert in this and not just because I really love junk food. But when it comes to wings, there's a couple things you could do. I mean, the first one is really patting down the wings with paper towel to get them as dry as possible. Dehydration is a huge part of creating crispiness. Then in our recipe, you line a baking sheet with two layers of foil because you're gonna have chicken fat dripping. It's a huge mess. And inside the baking sheet, you put a wire rack. And if you don't have one, I have used the wire rack from my toaster oven before. You got to adapt. Well, and the wire rack is great because it keeps that airflow underneath the wings, so it gets crispy all around. However, if you don't have one and you bake them on the foil, which you should maybe put a little oil down first so they don't stick, it'll still get really crispy because, you have a really hot oven going on. Then you put the whatever rub you're going to do on the wings. The Basically recipe uses a little bit of baking soda, which helps dehydrate the wings in the oven, and they cook slow at first so that they dehydrate, and then the second half of the bake is super high. And that's kind of the technique that I swear by. I've seen some online where people prefer baking powder. Obviously there's the air fryer. You have a lot of options, and I think if you're making wings for the first time, I would go with the Basically buffalo wing recipe because there's video too to help you along each step.
I think that we can't really talk about crispy things, be they wings or chips, without talking about dips and sauces. I guess it kind of depends on what you're starting with, like a salty chip or a sweet and spicy wing. But do you have any favorite snacks or dips that might work in a game-watching setting?
I will absolutely be making queso for the Super Bowl, one of my favorite foods of all time. I grew up in Texas, so there's probably queso literally in my bloodstream, and I should talk to my doctor about it. But I love queso, and I will be eating an egregious amount of it on Super Bowl Sunday. And I have a pro tip for your readers about queso, which is that I have frozen it before. When I made a recipe that was for a crowd, but it was just me eating it, which is going to happen again, I froze a container of it, and you have maybe a month, maybe 2 months before it goes through the scientific process called getting weird. But let me tell you what joy it is to defrost a container of queso on a random Monday night in March. It is heaven. So I will be
Wait a second. Queso.
That doesn't sound like, I didn't know that like cheese products could freeze at all. You're telling me that's a thing?
I don't think that's recommended in, you know, in the mainstream media, let's say, but I've done it before and it worked. So that's my anecdotal evidence. You could take it or leave it.
You're blowing my mind. Do you have a policy on basic sour cream dip? I mean, you're in a part of the country where Hidden Valley Ranch is kind of the way. It is the way, but I don't know. I mean, I've had some homemade varietals that I liked a lot.
If you're feeling crafty and you want to make homemade ranch, go for it. I've written an entire article about how much I love Jet's Ranch dressing, which I have a squeeze bottle of in my fridge, so I'll be using that from my wings, but for sour cream based like dips, I love them all. We have a recipe where you just kind of cook some shallots and you have a sort of a shallot-y yogurt dip that feels healthier because you're not using sour cream. But I'll let you decide. Those are all good. I do like the grocery store Dean's French onion dip. It's so nostalgic with some ruffles. If you're feeling motivated to make your own dip, do it, but I think the Super Bowl is a time for you to indulge in all your favorite junk foods.
You and the crispy shallots, you really had my back on Thanksgiving with the green bean casserole. That really sang. So I'm going to trust you on this one, too. Thank you for all the wonderful advice.
Anytime. Thanks, April.
Alex Beggs is a senior staff writer at Bon Appetit. You can find her full column in Bon Appetit's February issue. It's on newsstands right now. Up next, Michigan's prohibition history. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A century ago, prohibition was in full swing across the nation. Michigan actually got a head start on the rest of the United States, and the result was a soft opening for alcohol smugglers to practice their trade. Before long, an alcohol triangle between Windsor, Detroit, and Toledo took form, partly fueled by an increasingly popular mode of transportation, the automobile. Historian and Monroe resident Joe Boggs has written a new book called Prohibition's Proving Ground that explores this peculiar time in Michigan history. Joe Boggs, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April, for having me. It's a pleasure.
So you point out that it's hard to understand what was going on in Michigan during Prohibition without thinking about the huge sea change that had just fundamentally changed life here, the advent of the automobile. How did you start to become aware of these parallel tracks within history?
Well, I think one of the perspectives that really gives me, a head start on this perspective is the fact that I actually teach at a public vocational high school. And therefore, I have to teach from a way that kind of integrates industry with history. So I teach here at Penner Career Center, just south of Toledo. And it really got me thinking about the ways in which I could teach history through the lens of different industries, specifically in this case, the automobile.
You describe what was happening in Michigan at the time as the advent of the culture of automobility. How were cars changing people's lives in the 19-teens when the buzz about prohibition started to build?
It really was kind of an unbelievable moment to live in this region. With John Willys setting up shop with the Overland Willys Company in Toledo, you had, you know, obviously the Ford Motor Company in Detroit, in the Detroit area. You had over in Canada, Gordon McGregor setting up Ford Motor Company of Canada there. So it really is kind of an automobile boom that allows people to find jobs. Like, for instance, in Windsor area, 40% of the employees were actually working in the automobile industry in the 1910s and 20s. So it's really an unbelievable moment in terms of thinking about the way that the car impacts the economy, but also the way in which people can enjoy life. There's tons of people in this region who essentially never wandered beyond their farm or their hometown, and now they have that ability to do that. And that also brings about the creation of good roads. A lot of people don't realize the roads during this time period, the 1910s, were basically muddy swamps, essentially. And there was the Dixie Highway that ran through Monroe County that was notoriously known as full of ruts. You get stuck almost all times of the year. So this really brought about better roads in our region.
So here we are at this time when Michigan's undergoing some big economic and social and cultural changes. And Detroit was going through exponential growth on its way to becoming the fourth most populous city in the country. What was important geographically speaking about this Toledo-Detroit-Windsor corridor for people who were trying to buy and sell alcohol?
What's really interesting about this region are the competing patchwork of legislation that's occurring with prohibition. So for instance, most people don't realize that prohibition really starts in America in a patchwork fashion. There's various states that adopt it before the national prohibition of the 18th Amendment in 1920. So for instance, in Michigan, prohibition starts in 1918, but Ohio doesn't adopt it. So therefore, you could go down to Toledo, Ohio as a Michigan resident, purchase booze, and then try to smuggle it back. At first, they were trying to smuggle it back through the Interurban, which is an electric trolley system that operated between Toledo and Detroit. But eventually, you know, obviously with the automobile, it was much easier. You could determine when you could transport that booze. The cops would just be reactive. Whereas if you're on a trolley, you know, these agents could just board the trolley and bust you. But with the car, you can determine when you smuggle that booze.
I was absolutely fascinated by the idea of smuggling booze via trolley. I mean, were people actually trying to do it by the crate load, or were they just carrying as much as they could by hand?
It's humorous. At first, what happens is you have these just ordinary people who are going down to get a drink in Toledo and get drunk, but then they realize they can make money from it. So they're putting their coat pockets and so forth. But then the agents quickly find that out. So eventually they get more creative. Fake Bibles, fake babies. There were women who would get on the Interurban in places like Detroit or Monroe, go down very skinny, come back 8 months pregnant.
Pregnant because they were carrying bottles of illegal alcohol under their coats.
Exactly. They had like straps of bladders around their stomach. And then eventually the Michigan State Police actually had to hire matron officers to start searching women.
So Michigan, from the way you put it in the book, Michigan sounds like it was something of a battleground state in terms of the larger picture of prohibition. Could you sort of cast who was on each side of the dry vote and the wet vote at the time?
Yes, absolutely. So most people realize that prohibition is very unsuccessful prior to the 1910s, even though there's these major organizations like the Anti-Saloon League, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and the National Prohibition Party. Even though they're very powerful, no one's really buying into their argument. What happens in the 1910s is you have people like Henry Ford and a lot of the automobile tycoons of the region putting their force behind the prohibition law.
Why did the automakers have a stake in this?
Well, because, you know, when you're thinking about the reasons you would hope for a more productive workforce, obviously, if you have drunk workers who are constantly coming to work, causing inefficiencies, getting injured on the job, and you would also have tons of saloons and actually breweries and distilleries right outside the factory gates. Henry Ford is talking about this all the time. John Willys in Toledo actually talks about building the world's largest restaurant in his factory so that his employees don't go to the saloons during their work break.
Jeez. What did it mean for prohibition to have two states like Michigan and Ohio right next to each other with such different policies?
It creates a mess. Essentially, Toledo is known as the place where you go and do whatever you wish. And this is a place, from what I can gather, a lot of the Toledo businesses were supporting this smuggling activity because they knew it was very lucrative. Whereas in Michigan, you have, well, not necessarily in the Monroe County, Wayne County areas, but throughout the rest of the state, there was this movement to really crack down on smuggling and drinking. But unfortunately, a lot of people don't realize that Monroe County and Wayne County, they had voted actually against the state prohibition measure. So there was a hive of individuals in these counties, the Toledo-Detroit-Windsor corridor, that were in favor of drinking. So it makes this a very challenging thing because you have Lansing wanting to enforce the law, but then you have local residents in Monroe County and Wayne County not really wanting to comply with the law.
So at the same time as prohibition laws were getting underway, this was also an important time in America for organized crime. What did the advent of the automobile mean for illegal activity?
It meant everything, plain and simple. It meant everything in terms of, like I said earlier, being able to engage in criminal activity when you wanted, how you wanted, and where you wanted. But also, you know, later in the prohibition years when organized crime becomes much more developed and much more brutal. These are tools of murder. The gangsters, the Purple Gang, the Yikaboli Gang down here in Toledo, they use these tools, these automobiles, to hijack, to murder fellow gang members who are kind of budging in on their territory. They use them to abduct people and then drive them off into essentially secluded areas of places like Monroe County, of places like Wayne County on the edges of the peripheries, and drop them off. It was very common to hear of these bodies just being found everywhere, and it was very clear that automobiles have dropped them off at a secluded road. One story I can think of, there was a Toledo car dealer. He had been involved with a gang down in the Toledo area, obviously, and he's abducted. His body is dropped off in Monroe County Road. The gangsters come back to the house where their boys were sleeping, and they ordered the boy to go across the street to get the newspaper to read about their father who had just been killed. Terrific.
Wow. Straight up Boardwalk Empire stuff.
Exactly.
What were the main arteries for the rum-running trade when we get to the point that both Michigan and Ohio are under national prohibition laws?
The major artery was Canada. So Canada has the Ontario Temperance Act, which does ban the sale of alcohol for residents in the Windsor area. However, you can still manufacture it and you can still export it. So therefore, you have this country that's very thirsty and they're going to make a lot of money off that. So Windsor, for the most part, really does cooperate, not necessarily on a legal standpoint, but on an underworld standpoint. They are supporting the thirsty people of Michigan and Ohio. And so it comes directly across the river. And once again, people underestimate the importance of cars here. Obviously, historians have documented the waterborne traffic coming from Windsor to the downriver and Detroit communities, but you need cars to transport that to customers.
It sounds like Michigan wasn't only important as a market in and of itself, but as a pathway for alcohol that was coming to other parts of the U.S. from Canada, right?
Exactly. And I think a lot of people think of prohibition with Chicago, but Chicago's prohibition culture doesn't exist without Detroit's prohibition culture. And I would argue, in fact, that the prohibition narrative begins and belongs in Detroit, not in Chicago.
Could you say more about that?
Yeah. So, for instance, we know that Al Capone and a lot of the Chicago area gangsters, they had to essentially establish ties with Detroit's gangsters, the Purple Gang, and those who controlled the rum trade. And there's this one story that you can't prove that Al Capone was in this town, but there's a town that I grew up in, Newport, Michigan, in 1920, at the very beginning of national prohibition. There's an officer that's abducted by Chicago gangsters in the downtown area of Newport. And the gangsters essentially ask him, what's the back way up to Detroit? We need to establish these ties. They throw him out the car. When they get back, if you document everything together and see what's happening in Chicago, Big Jim Colosimo, who was Al Capone's boss, was just assassinated a few days prior. He did not want Capone to get involved in the bootlegging business, so he gets whacked. And historians point to the fact that Al Capone quickly thereafter tried to establish ties with the Purple Gang because of the needed access to that quality booze that was coming out of Canada.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Joe Boggs. He has a new book called Prohibition's Proving Ground that explores early 19th century crime and enforcement in Michigan around the sale of alcohol. So, Joe, one of the things that was such a revelation about this book was the reminder that a lot of law enforcement didn't actually even have their own cars in those days. Can you guess maybe how many regular police or state police might have had access to vehicles at the time when Michigan's prohibition laws started going into effect?
Very few. They were on horse at first. And in fact, they had to set up roadblocks to stop the cars that were coming in. Sometimes you would have officers confiscate the rum runners' cars to transport them to the jails. So it was very few. And in fact, one of the earliest automobiles that's used by the state troopers at the Michigan-Ohio border is actually called Little Bertha. It was an armored vehicle from World War I, and it was meant to stop the rum runners who were driving through their blockades of horses and just, you know, regular stops. But eventually that Little Bertha armored vehicle was pulled off the road because you couldn't really see out the front of it, and it crashed into regular cars. So that wasn't very successful.
You tell this story in the book that was just hitting home as I was reading it on a very cold winter's day. It's a story from February of 1919, when the Michigan State Police were just in the early stages of trying to stop rum-running gangs before they had armored vehicles, before some of the escalation. Could you set the scene for us?
Yeah, so what happens that night in February is that the head of the state troopers learns that there's a convoy of cars coming up the Dixie Highway from Toledo. So they're ready for them around 3 a.m. And sure enough, these cars come through. And the first squad tries to stop them just south of Monroe on the Dunbar Road. But then they blow by their position, the rum runners. So they signal up the road. The second squad drops a telephone pole on the road. And one of the cars is going 60 miles per hour, hits that telephone pole. And as the newspapers describe it, turned turtle on the street. All the booze flows out. Two rum runners were kind of severely injured. And they actually made up a kind of, I think it seems to be a legend of a third person that was killed, that the police had basically took their body away. It becomes a very controversial touch point. The governor actually of Michigan at that time actually comes down on the state troopers never to do that again. And eventually, the officers are sued a few years later for $2,000 for damages.
I mean, there's so much. I don't even know where to start with this whole story. Just the thought of them dropping a telephone pole across the road. The fact that the rum runners drove right into it. I mean, I guess that speaks to automotive braking technology of the time more than anything else. And the fact that the public was sort of outraged by this is very interesting as well. I mean, you write that there was some questioning, you know, well, why didn't the state police just establish toll booths? Joe, do you have a sense of how much alcohol was coming through the Toledo-Detroit-Windsor corridor by the time prohibition was at its height and the illegal trade was at its height?
Oh, it's hard to estimate. I know one historian, Philip Mason, has estimated that 75% of the alcohol that was being consumed in the United States during Prohibition actually came through that a funnel of Windsor in the Detroit River area. I do know at the very beginning, it was estimated at the very beginning of national Prohibition that 900,000 cases flowed over the Detroit River in the first 6 months.
Wow.
Now, one thing to think about as well here is the trade didn't stop when the water froze over. Model Ts and cars were flowing across the ice at all times of the winter. There was one interview that I read. She lived in the Monroe County region along the beaches there. And she said it was like growing up as a kid, it was like blackbirds descending upon the beach in the ice, the Model Ts. It was just unbelievable, she said.
Jeez. The other jaw dropper for me was just how much money was tied up in rum running. You write about the Billingsley gang getting involved in Michigan. Can you describe the scale of their investments once they decided they were going to try to get a toehold in the market?
Yes. So the Billingsley gang actually moved from the states of Kansas and Washington, which had previous state prohibition legislation, and they actually realized that the Toledo-Detroit area was going to be more lucrative. So they go ahead and purchase a fleet of vehicles, several warehouses in Toledo, and they establish business ties with Detroit grocerymen to funnel alcohol up to them. And eventually they're caught in the fall of 1918, very early on in the state prohibition days. But they had made a couple $100,000 just in the 2 months. And we know this because there was an agent that infiltrated them. So if they were allowed to continue to work for, you know, the remainder of that year, they probably could have easily made close to $1 million because they were just starting.
Just the thought of them setting up not just a warehouse, but essentially buying these grocery chains, it just must have been an incredible amount of money for that time.
Exactly. Yeah, these individuals were highly organized. They knew what they were doing. And like we said, a lot of Americans don't realize there was a patchwork of legislation across the country. So there was organized crime in a lot of different states. But really, Toledo-Detroit area was the mecca of organized crime because of the automobility of the region. Cars were essential tools for these criminals, and very few other places had as many cars. And in fact, I would argue, actually, they didn't have as many cars as this area.
Joe Boggs' new book is Prohibition's Proving Ground, Cops, Cars, and Rum Runners in the Toledo-Detroit-Windsor Corridor. It's out on the University of Toledo Press. Joe, thank you so much for the book. It's a really, really interesting wintertime read. And thanks for talking to us about it, too.
Thank you so much, April.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. Catch you on the flip side.